welcome to the Second Court of Appeals afternoon session. We have two cases for oral argument this afternoon on the 130 docket, and then we'll have a panel change for the third case. I believe that both of the first two cases are here and ready.
Yes, that's correct.
I'll ask Megan to call the first case then, and we'll go ahead and get started if that's all right.
The court will now call Town Hall Estates versus Cannon. May it please the court, Mr. Scott Freeman to argue for appellant and Mr. Bob Green to argue for appellate.
May it please the court. I'm Scott Fraley on behalf of appellant Town Hall Estates, Arlington, Inc. This is an interlocutory appeal of a health care liability claim. Although typically the appeal of a motion to dismiss in a health care liability claim is reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, we believe here the issue is a straightforward one of statutory construction, in which case a de novo rule of construction applies. The essential facts of the case are not in dispute. Appellee Lucy Cannon filed suit against Town Hall Estates on May 8, 2009, alleging she was dropped from a Hoyer lift and broke her leg. Pursuant to Chapter 74.351 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Cannon's expert report was due within 120 days of the filing of her petition or on September 5, 2009. Without filing any expert report, Ms. Cannon non-suited her claim on September 3, 2009. Now, Cannon refiled the identical suit, same parties, same causes of action, same allegations, on February 5, 2010, about 8 months after the filing of her first petition. On February 17, 2010, Cannon served appellant with the expert report of Dr. Liege Rushing, the first expert report to be produced in her lawsuit. Town Hall then moved to dismiss on the grounds that Cannon had not met the 120-day deadline under Chapter 74.351 to file her expert report. That motion to dismiss was heard by Honorable Jeff Walker in the court below, and Judge Walker denied the motion to dismiss.
Isn't the issue really whether the 2005 amendments changed prior law?
I think that is essentially the issue, Your Honor.
Are there any cases interpreting the 2005 amendment in the context of a motion to dismiss or a non-suit?
There are not any that specifically address the issue of what happens in the event of a non-suit. The only case of which I am aware that is a post-amendment appeal under Chapter 74 is the case actually relied on by Appellee, the Hayes versus Carroll case. And I think it's interesting that Ms. Cannon relies on Hayes versus Carroll because we believe it totally supports the position of appellant. Hayes stands for two things. Number one, the court in Hayes points out that the statutory analysis, the legislative history that went into the 2005 amendment of Chapter 74.351 was addressed to a very narrow issue, specifically the issue of whether the 120-day deadline runs from the filing of the original petition or the filing of a statutory or service of a statutory notice letter. The legislative history specifically addresses that issue in the 2005 bill analysis by the Civil Practices Committee. It specifically states that our issue is and the purpose of the amendment is to clarify whether the 120-day clock runs from the filing of the petition rather than service of the statutory notice letter, because there had been some confusion about that issue. Likewise, in the hearings before the Senate Affairs Committee, Senator Wentworth stated that the legislature's only concern in making the 2005 amendment was to clarify that the trigger is the filing of the original petition, not the notice letter. There is nothing whatever in the legislative history, and this is pointed out in the Hayes case, to suggest that there was an intent by the legislature to rewrite the pre-existing law under Chapter 74.351. In fact, the court specifically noted in talking about the legislative history that here's what they said about it. They said that a construction of 74.351A that interprets the term original petition as being the first document filed in a case that brings a claim against a defendant or constitutes the filing of a lawsuit against a defendant is consistent with the available legislative history. That's the trigger. Now, the issue in Hayes was not whether you could non-suit and refile and extend the 120 days. The issue there was simply whether if the original petition didn't name a particular defendant, and then subsequently there was a later petition that did add that defendant, did that restart the 120-day clock as to that subsequent defendant? And the court logically found, well, sure, you've got to have a petition naming the defendant before the 120-day clock runs as to an expert report with regard to that defendant. That was the only issue addressed in Hayes. But what the court held with regard to the scope of the amendment and what the amendment intended to do with regard to the trigger was this. They said, in the present case, the event that triggered the deadline for serving appellants with the expert reports at issue in this case was the first pleading filed by Carroll stating claims against appellants. Now, if you apply that law to this case, the first pleading filed by Ms. Cannon against appellant Town Hall Estates was the one on May 8, 2009. Clearly, under all the case law that is extant, the rule still stands that the 120 days runs from the filing of the first petition making a claim against that defendant in that case. And the case law, including McCullough versus Meade, which we rely on heavily in our brief, specifically states that in that context, when we're talking about a lawsuit, we're referring to a claim, not a particular cause number or cause of action. That case law has been followed by virtually every court of appeals in the state that has addressed this issue. The only case that I'm aware of that was originally a writ granted case that went up and then subsequently was changed to a writ denied case was the White case. And again, the Court of Appeals held in that case that the running of the 120 days is from the filing of the first petition naming that defendant. We believe that is the rule. Now, there are three bases essentially on which we rely. Number one, the legislative history, as I've already talked about, under the amendment, the 2005 amendment, makes it clear that there was only a narrow issue being addressed. What is the trigger date? It's not the notice letter, it's the petition. Secondly, it has been conceded by Appellee that the prior case law interpreting the 2003 statute would bar her claim. There's no question that under all the cases decided under the 2003 version of Chapter 74.351, that the plaintiff cannot non-suit and then refile in an effort to extend the 120-day deadline. Now, there's nothing in the legislative history, nothing that we've been able to find, certainly nothing cited by Appellee, that suggests that in making the 2005 amendment, the legislature intended a broader change in the law. Now, what we do also know is that the legislature in 2003, when they implemented the Chapter 74 scheme, revised the pre-existing scheme under Chapter 4590I, Section 13.01. Under 13.01, there was a specific provision that said the plaintiff has the option either to file an expert report within 180 days, which was the old deadline, or to non-suit. And non-suit was specifically an option under that statute. When the 2003 amendment was entered into by the legislature, they deleted that option. And all the case law has said, it's clear the legislative intent was to apply the purposes of the reform statute, the health care reform statute, which was to reduce cost, try to get rid of claims that were frivolous or without a reasonable basis, and to reduce the expense and time incurred by the parties. Now, with regard to the 2005 amendment, there's no indication that the court intended any different result. In fact, once the legislature has deleted language from a statute, the Court of Appeals is to assume that the legislature intended the deletion, and it is improper under Supreme Court law for the Court of Appeals to reinstate language deleted by the legislature, which we believe is what the appellee is asking the court to do here. Essentially, what Ms. Cannon is asking this Court of Appeals to do is to take what the legislative history suggests was a very narrow change in the 2005 law and to expand it into a dramatic change in the law that essentially would revert from the 2003 regime under Chapter 74 to the old 4590I Section 13.01 scheme, where you have the option to take a non-suit as an alternative to timely filing your expert report. There is absolutely nothing, any legislative history, any case law, or any other source offered by the appellee or that we have been able to locate to suggest that is the law.
Is there any way that the statute can be reconciled with a rule? I mean, you just don't have a right to a non-suit in a health care liability claim?
It has been reconciled, Your Honor, and that issue was specifically addressed in both McCullough versus Reed and its companion case, Darcy versus Meade. And that issue was specifically raised and addressed by the Court of Appeals, the Houston 14th Court of Appeals. And they said, no, the plaintiff continues to have a right to non-suit. Rule 162 continues to apply. However, we believe that the way that you reconcile Chapter 74 with Rule 162 is to say that Chapter 74 gives the plaintiff, up until limitations has run, to get an expert and timely file their lawsuit. But it doesn't give them the right to come in and file a lawsuit without any expert support, not be able to get expert report within 120 days, non-suit, and then refile. The other reason that we know that that should be the law, Your Honor, is because Chapter 74.002 specifically provides that to the extent of any conflict between Chapter 74 and any other law, rule, or regulation, Chapter 74 trumps. Therefore, if there were a conflict, as between Rule 162 and Chapter 74, Chapter 74 would govern, even though it would have a harsh result. And the Supreme Court has recognized there are aspects of Chapter 74 that are going to, in some cases, have what could be considered to be a harsh result, including dismissal of claims. But that is what the legislature intended. The legislative purposes are served by the statutes as they have written them, and we believe that continues to be the purpose of Chapter 74 as expressed by the legislature, including in the 2005 amendment.
Were any of the interpretations in the cases already on the books when the 2005 amendment was proposed and adopted? Any of the case law holding that a non-suit under the 2003 legislation wouldn't restart the 120 days?
I don't believe so. I think the earliest case that came down in that time frame was the 2006 cases out of the Houston 14th Court of Appeals. I don't believe that there was a 2005 case so holding. I will say, however, Your Honor, that there has now been some 5 years, close to it, of law developing that rule, which the legislature had the opportunity to address and has clearly chosen not to, if it felt like that was inappropriate in terms of interpretation of the intent of Chapter 74.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Bob Wynn.
Good afternoon, Madam Justices. My name is Bob Wynn, and I represent the appellee plaintiff, Lucy Cannon, in this matter. May it please the court, essentially what Town Hall is asking this court to do is to read a statute, to disregard the plain language of the statute, to disregard the fact that their reading will create numerous internal inconsistencies within Chapter 74, the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, to disregard the fact that their reading of the statute will constrict common law rights in derogation of case law, to disregard the fact that their reading of the statute will create an unnecessary conflict with Rule 162 of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. And they're asking you to do all this based on unclear legislative history that doesn't even reach the specific point that's issued in front of this court. When they asked the district judge to do that, he wisely refused based on the same arguments that are being presented to this panel today.
Mr. Wynn, what internal inconsistencies do you believe that the appellant's construction of the statute will create?
There's a number of them, Your Honor, and the first one is the term original petition. When Chapter 74 was enacted in 2003, the term original petition appeared once in the entire chapter, and that was in Section 74.352, which is the statute that follows 351, which is at issue today. Original petition, as used in that section, says that once an original petition is filed, the plaintiff has 45 days to answer the statutory interrogatories and the statutory request for production. Now, if you take their reading of original petition and apply it to Section 352, you have some serious problems, and this is one of them. If I file a lawsuit on behalf of my client and I non-suit the next day or a week later, if you take that original petition, meaning the first filed lawsuit, I would still have to answer discovery 45 days later, even though there's no lawsuit on the books. And one of the rules of statutory construction is you read the same term in different statutes within the same chapter identically. And if you read it the way that the appellant requests you to do, it would create an absurdity that a plaintiff would have to provide discovery in a lawsuit that's not on file. And one of the rules in statutory construction is you read statutes to prevent absurdities, to prevent unfair results. That would be the first internal inconsistency. The second would be what appellant is really asking is for you to read original petition to mean a lawsuit or a action, meaning that any time a first filed petition or first filed lawsuit or first filed actions on the books, that triggers a running period. And essentially what that is saying that the legislature didn't understand or didn't know what the term a lawsuit or an civil action means. And the problem with that is in Chapter 74, the term in a suit is used in seven separate statutes. It's used in Section 051, 053, Section 101, Section 153, Section 401, Section 402, and Section 403. And so to the extent that appellant is asking this court to read the original petition to mean a lawsuit or a first filed lawsuit, the legislature clearly knew what it was doing when it chose not to use that term. And that's evidenced by seven separate statutes in the same chapter. And the same goes for the term an action, meaning a civil action. That term's used in five separate statutes in Chapter 74. The first is Section 154. The second is Section 251. The third is Section 301. The fourth is Section 302. And the fifth is Section 303. And this goes exactly to the same point as a suit. If the legislature intended a original petition to mean the same thing as any civil action on file, they knew that term, they had used it in 2003, and they certainly could have used the exact same wording in 2005 to pass the meaning that they intended. And so those would be 13 internal inconsistencies in the exact same chapter if you applied the meaning that appellant requests you to do today. Most important in any statutory construction analysis is the plain expressed language of the statute. And in his opening argument, counsel said that Ms. Cannon couldn't cite you to any case law or couldn't cite you to any legislative history in support of its position.
Well, you do cite to the case that you made reference to, which is Page versus Carroll, and in your argument you said that the legislative intent was unclear. But it seems like in my reading of Hayes versus Carroll, well, tell me how it shows that the legislative intent was unclear in the 2005 amendment, and also tell me how you think that that case actually supports your position.
First off, the legislative history is unclear because in the 2005 amendment, what the legislature is saying or clarifying is that the 120-day period is triggered by the filing of a lawsuit. Nowhere in the legislative history does it say it's triggered by the filing of the first lawsuit or any lawsuit. It's triggered by the filing of the, meaning a definite article, original petition. An original petition is a term of art in civil practice. You can have multiple original petitions for the same cause of action between the same parties. You can't have multiple causes of action. Whereas you can't have multiple original petitions. And that's what the McCullough case from the 14th District Houston Court of Appeals says. Getting back to the second point, how Hayes supports us. Hayes supports us to the extent that courts, district courts and courts of appeal are unwilling to read a statute or construe it to prevent substantive rights they have been previously recognized in the common law. What Hayes said was that when you file your first lawsuit against one defendant, it doesn't trigger expert report deadlines against other defendants who haven't already been named. And the reason that is because it would be fundamentally unfair and would deprive a claimant of her common law rights and a health care liability claim to read that statute so narrowly and so strictly. And that's essentially what appellant is asking this court to do here today.
But that court construed the 2005 amendments to have the same effect as the 2003 law. It didn't change anything. You're asking for it to change. You agree under the 2003 law that you couldn't restart the clock, correct?
Your Honor, I believe that's crystal clear under every case that's been decided.
Okay. But they found that the 2005 amendments didn't change the law in that instance, but you're saying in this instance it should?
Well, Hayes is factually distinguishable. Hayes didn't involve a non-suit. Hayes just involved filing a first amended or second amended petition adding new defendants in the same lawsuit. We have a completely different situation here where we have one original petition that gets dismissed, then we file a subsequent original petition in a separate lawsuit against the same defendant. And that's what implicates Rule 162. Hayes really doesn't touch on the substantive analysis of this lawsuit. Hayes essentially sets forth general guidelines that courts consider in construing statutes, what the goals are to be preserved or what's meaningful to them. But it really doesn't get into the meat of this matter, Your Honor. In addition, I guess that would be a good segue into the derogation of the common law rights. Prior to 1977, when the original health care liability statute was passed, claimants had the ability to file freely. There were no restrictions on it. Restrictions on them in bringing their Med-Mal claims. I mean, there's no caps, there's no expert reports, there's no deadlines like that. And what case law supports is that when you have a statute that restricts well-known and well-recognized common law rights, that the courts are required to construe that narrowly, to limit claimants' rights as little as possible, not to take these broad jumps and say that there's now a self-triggering 120-day statute of repose that had never existed in the history of Texas case law and that currently only exists in this one unique chapter.
Well, I would agree with you, except for the 2003 amendments already restricted the common law cause of action. What you're saying is that the 2005 amendment then broadened it again.
And on that point, Your Honor, I would go to the actual language that the legislature used. In 2003, they used the term claim, and claim is defined in Chapter 74 as any cause of action. They subsequently changed that to mean the original petition, which refers to the actual lawsuit at issue at the time the non-suit was filed. And under that plain reading of that statute, it has to be construed narrowly. And to the extent that it would be a reversion to the pre-2003, I believe that's a question that's best addressed to the legislature to resolve, to the extent that they felt that or believe that that's not what they intended. Their language that they actually used doesn't back up their subjective thoughts.
So you're saying the 2005 amendment reverted back to the law prior to the 2003 amendment? Because they knew when they put in that language that said you could non-suit, they knew what that meant, then they took that specific language out and they didn't put it back in 2005.
Your Honor, I would disagree, and I believe this is the point that Justice Gardner raised in one of her questions to counsel. The McCullough opinion, and I believe the remainder are the ones, Doherty, Runcie, and Easley, the four appellate decisions that talk about non-suits, weren't actually on the books at the time of the 2005 amendments. And because of that, if they were, this court could construe that the legislature was aware of them and made a conscious decision that it knew what it was doing. The fact that they weren't on the books mean the legislature was not informed or not aided by those opinions. And I don't believe it's a reversion back to the pre-2000 case law. It's a clarification in that they use this different word, and that these words that the legislature uses have meaning. They can't just be considered, you know, not to exist or to be whited out or to be amended based on legislative history. The court doesn't even get to the legislative history until it believes that there's some type of ambiguity or lack of clarity in the actual language of the statute. And I think that's one of the...
I thought we were allowed to rely on the statutory construction aids in 311.011, regardless of whether or not the language was ambiguous.
And that's correct, Your Honor, that there's a May discretionary statute that allows courts to do that.
And so if we can do that, the circumstances under which the statute was enacted remain the same, correct? And the consequences of the particular construction remain the same. And so those two features would remain the same under the 2003 amendment or under the 2005 amendment.
Your Honor, as a general matter, I would agree with that principle. But the Construction Act allows a court to do it. I believe the Construction Act was specifically passed in 1985. Since 1985, there's been 25 years of Texas Supreme Court decisions referring back to the Construction Act. And the Texas Supreme Court still says, notwithstanding that Construction Act, if the plain language is unambiguous, the court stop there and construe those words. So you'd have the...
You see the irony in that. You're telling us to... not apply the strict language in the Code of Construction Act, but to apply the strict language in 74351A.
I believe one of the fundamental differences between that is the use of the May term in the Code Construction Act, but more importantly is the case law from the Texas Supreme Court interpreting that act itself. Your Honors, I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Fraley, do you have a rebuttal?
Yes, ma'am.
Your Honors, we do have case law that addresses both the question of what was the legislative intent in the 2005 amendment and the question of how do we interpret the term original petition as used in the 2005 amendment. And the case that we have is the 2010 case, Hayes versus Carroll, out of the Austin Court of Appeals. And they're very specific about both those issues. And I want to read a couple things that they say, and I'm reading from page 502 of the opinion. First of all, with regard to the issue of the legislative history, here's what they say. No mention is made in the legislative history that the legislature was intending to create a significant substantive change to the law on when health care liability claims are extinguished. They clearly interpret the legislative history of the 2005 amendment, as does appellant, which is to apply to a very narrow issue. Are we talking about the trigger being the statutory notice letter? Are we talking about the trigger being the original petition? And clearly the legislature intended to address that by saying, no, we don't mean the notice letter, we mean the original petition. I think that's very straightforward. But to the extent that appellee's counsel wants to suggest, well, there's an ambiguity there, or I guess he said there's no ambiguity there, it clearly means the original petition and the most recently filed lawsuit. Again, that's not what the case law says, because that issue was likewise addressed in the Hayes opinion. And here's what they said, again reading from page 502. In the present case, the event that triggered the deadline for serving appellants with the expert reports at issue in this case was the first pleading filed by Carroll stating claims against appellants. The first pleading filed stating claims. Well, the first pleading filed stating claims against Town Hall Estates was on May 8, 2009, and 120 days from that was September 2009, and we didn't get an expert report until February of 2010, some 8 months after the original petition, as the 2005 amendment uses that term, was filed. I believe it's very straightforward for this court to determine that under those circumstances, the claims that are brought by Ms. Cannon are barred. The question was asked, you know, how is the legislative history unclear? Well, we believe it's crystal clear about what the intent was, and we don't believe it's proper for the court to read out the legislative history that we do have and to somehow look at the language and read into it a different legislative intent than that was stated when Chapter 74 was first passed, or that has been applied or interpreted since the passage of Chapter 74 over the last 5 years.
How do you address Mr. Wynn's argument that the term original petition as used elsewhere in the statute has a specific meaning that's inconsistent with the meaning that you're wanting to ascribe to it under 74351A?
I don't agree that it does, that the statute does use it inconsistently. I believe it is consistently used to reference a claim, and that specifically a healthcare liability claim, and that, in fact, that has been the interpretation consistently made by the courts that have looked at the non-suit issue, is that what we're talking about is a healthcare liability claim. And it doesn't matter how many times or how many ways you bring it, if you're talking about the same claim and the same plaintiff and the same defendant, the same causes of action, that constitutes the claim. And that's what defines the original petition. And we believe that that is the law and should continue to be the law. In short, Your Honors, appellant sees nothing in the case law, nothing in the legislative history, nothing in the language of the statute that would suggest that this court should undo the original statutory intent, several years of interpretation and application of that intent, and that under these circumstances, pursuant to 74.351, appellant was entitled to mandatory dismissal of the claims against it and to an award of sanctions in the form of fees and expenses. And we would request that this court reverse and render judgment to that effect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fraley. Thank you both, Mr. Wynn, also, for your very good arguments, and your case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May we be excused?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excused.